And this February, he will reach his 23rd dry year in AA. I'm glad to give you Clarence tonight.
Thank you very much. I want to get this out of the way. This thing bothers me. I just think that's something maybe they use on speakers after they think they've had enough. Well, I am Clarence Snyder. I live in St. Petersburg, Florida. And the first thing I want to do is to thank the group here and the committee for inviting me. I have never been to a meeting in Texas. I've never had the pleasure of meeting with Texas people. I've been in a good many states, AA-wise, but Texas was my first trip. And I must say I'm quite impressed. For one thing, you know, I suppose you folks in Texas get a little ribbon now and then about this being second largest now. I'll say one thing about it. You may not be the largest state in the Union anymore, but they're going to have to go some to beat you in hospitality. Why, you know, before I came down here, things were taken care of for me. Our friend Johansson over here sent me my Texas passport so I could move around Texas with impunity. And Alan sent me some United States money to get down here. And Johansson gave me some Texas money to spend here. I haven't been able to spend any of it, either the United States or the Texas money. Nobody will let me do that. It's wonderful here. I think I'll keep that Texas money, though. I'm going to pass it on to my heirs. Well, we're here tonight to talk about various things. Several people have asked me to talk about different phases of this program and my part in it. So I'm going to break my talk down into three parts. The first hour and 45 minutes, I am going to talk about my entrance to AA. The next hour and 20 minutes, I'm going to talk about the program and how I advise other people to use it. The last 3 minutes, I'm going to tell you what I do about it. We're going to talk about alcoholics and alcoholism in this program, this fellowship. I think perhaps it might be of interest to some of you folks here to know something about the early days of AA. I'm not going to dwell on it too much, but I'll dwell on it by telling you how I happened to get into this fellowship. Understand, as you just heard, I'm among the first 50 that had the privilege of aligning with this fellowship. Today, there are only 3 men living who have longer period of sobriety in AA than I have. Because the reason for that, of course, is they were much older men than I was when I came in. They weren't going to let me in. They didn't think I was old enough or ready, you know. And a lot of them have died and passed on, and others have disappeared. But my coming in here was an impossibility. It's one of those things that couldn't happen, but it did. The mathematical chances of my being in this fellowship were many millions to one against it. I happened to be having my very last chance by my wife to stay at home and straighten up. I had lost jobs and positions, and I was out of it and hadn't worked for quite some time. And my wife had a brother, bless his soul, who he had a truck, one of these big outfits, and he used to run from Cleveland to New York, one of those tractor trailer deals. And the family had a confab, and they made up the deal that if I would go out and be his helper, then I would prove myself, and then I could stay home and be one of the clan. Well, I have always been allergic to hard work all my life. I don't like calluses. In fact, I don't like work in any form. And being sober hasn't changed that either. But the idea of driving one of these trucks was quite appalling, but I had to do something. I had to make the bet good, so I agreed that I'd go out and be his helper. Well, I shall never forget. He got this sleeping cab all ready, cleaned up, washed the blankets, put little drapes in the windows, and the whole works. And we started off for New York from Cleveland. I was living in Cleveland at the time. So I was an everyday drinker. I was not a periodic. I never had the chance of having these free shows that a good many of you folks have had coming off of a drunk. I just stayed that way all the time, and I never got into these DTs. So I hadn't had a drink that day, and I was pretty sick. I didn't have any wardrobe. I had nothing but the pants and shirt and sweater and shoes and socks that I had. That was my wardrobe. I had sold my good clothes, my last two suits and my overcoat, which I considered my dress clothes. I had sold to Uncle Phil for $1.50. So my wardrobe was gone, and these were my earthly possessions. But I had something less than $2 in capital when I left with him, which he didn't know I had. I had this hidden. And they thought that I was completely broke, but I had collected milk bottles for a few days, and I had some money. Now, we start off for New York, and this was cold weather. Everything happens to me in the cold weather, and this was no exception. And we drove and we drove and we drove. He stopped several times for coffee. I couldn't handle coffee. I had the shakes. I was scared. I was cold. I was terrified. Every time I look out the back window of that cab and see that big thing following us down the road, the 20 tons of stuff in the back of us, and that thing would just terrify me. And having the shakes to boot, it wouldn't help any. So I just didn't think this fellow was ever going to quit. The next morning, we were over in New York State, and he stopped for breakfast. He stopped at one of these roadside stands, and they were selling orange juice and York State cheese, and that was breakfast. And he bought a gallon of this, or not orange juice, I'm from Florida, I'm not one orange, tomato juice this was. And he wanted me to drink some of that stuff, which I couldn't handle, and I couldn't eat the cheese either, so we went on and on. At any rate, that night we got to Albany, New York. I had no drink, I had nothing to eat, and he got pooped out by that time, and he thought he'd take a rest. Well, at last my hour had arrived. I told him, I said, I'm awful glad to be in Albany. I always wanted to see the government buildings in the state of New York. I don't know how it ever occurred to me that Albany was a capital, but it came to me like that. So he says, well, be back here in a half an hour, because that's all I'm going to snooze the half hour. So I beat it out of this cab, and away I went up the street, and I got into the first gin mill I saw. I turned right around, went out, because it was too high class for me. It was way out of my class. And I went down a couple blocks and got into the kind of society that is more fitting to a man of my estate. And in those days, you could get whiskey for a dime a shot if you weren't too particular what you drank. And I got into this place, and I started throwing these things in me as fast as I could. I can still remember part of that. And I started back for the truck, and on the way back, these things all hit me at once. So when I climbed up into the cab, I stepped on the poor boy's face, and church was out. He knew. Well, if he wasn't certain then, he was a little later. Because this nice, clean bed he fixed for me got rather messed up. So when we got to New York City, we got down on the waterfront, put the trailer, he'd taken the trailer off and delivered it somewhere. He took the tractor down there and he kicked me out and says, this is the end of the line, boy, you're on your own. And he wrote his sister, which was my wife, used to be, that was the end of the story. He told her what he'd done. So there I was in New York City, minus everything. I had 40 cents left. I can still remember that. I still had 40 cents of my capital. And I knew one person in the whole town. Now get this. This is back, way back, I don't know, probably 36 or 37, I suppose. 1937, I imagine. And things were tough. If you folks remember, we had a depression. This was before the war. This was when things were really rough. And I remembered Dorothy had a sister in Yonkers.
I couldn't forget her. We'd been there on our honeymoon some years before, and she came and lived with us for a year and a half, and she's having trouble with her husband. And during that time, she spent 6 months in a hospital, and I paid all her bills. So I couldn't forget her. So I thought, well, I'll go out and see Virginia. She'll certainly look after me. So I got out to Yonkers, and odd things happened here, you know. I got out there, it didn't cost me a dime. I was very lucky. I was on a streetcar that had an accident and got all messed up, and the conductor didn't collect our fares, and they sent another streetcar set another streetcar down, and I didn't have to pay on that car. I got out there for nothing. I thought that was quite a trick. I think we better wait till this thing clears up. It scares me. So when I got to Yonkers, I remembered where Virginia lived. She lived way up on a hill. But I didn't go up there. I went down a hill. You know, you probably know why. That is Italian section down there, and a lot of wine. You can do a lot with a little bit in a place like that, and I did. So then I started up and went up to her place. The only thing I remember about that visit, I was rolling around on the floor with her kids. And she was awful busy doing something. What she was doing, she was getting herself dressed so she could get me out of there. So she didn't do anything but put me in the car and take me right back down to the waterfront and dump me out where I came from. So I was in New York. Didn't know a soul. Didn't have a dime. That's it. Winter setting in. No overcoat, no nothing. So it was quite a deal. Anybody ever think they've been lonesome? Or had a feeling of loneliness or aloneness, I want you to consider the situation I was in at that time. I shall never forget it. Well, anyway, I spent a long time in New York. I found out how to live there for nothing and get paid for it. I had a good deal worked out. I'm not going to tell any for a price. I'll let some of you fellas in on it. But I found out how to eat for nothing. I used to watch these trucks for these fellas at night as a night watchman. They give me 50 cents a night for sleeping in one of these trucks. Wonderful. I had a place, come out of trouble. 50 cents, I could buy all the mix I could drink and more. So I kept in a rosy glow all this time and had a good, clean place to sleep. So the eating wasn't important, but I found out how to do that without spending any money. So anyway, here's why I tell this long, drawn-out story. Sometime later, Virginia had her doctor out for one of the kids in Yonkers. And she got to talking to the doctor. They got talking about drinking. And she told this doctor about this brother-in-law of hers that she used to think was quite a guy at one time and who is now nothing but a drunken bum. And she told about the experience of me coming out there and what a disgrace I was. What a filthy bum. This doctor said, you know, that's odd. He says, I have a brother-in-law. He used to be a drunk like that. But he met some cult. He got mixed up with some cult here. And he hasn't drank since. And he also knows some drunken doctor in Akron, Ohio, who joined this cult. And he says that doctor in Akron spends all his time fixing up drunks. He says, now, if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland again, maybe they can steer him down to this doctor. Maybe they can get him straightened around. Now, imagine, there is my mathematical chances. This doctor was Dr. Strong, who happens to be Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. And he's talking about Dr. Bob Smith in Akron, Ohio. Now, the chances of me ever meeting this is impossible, but it happened. Why? Well, anyway, sometime later, I don't know, it must have been a year, I suppose, because I went around the seasons, I remember that. I didn't keep track of time. I had no reason to. I had no worries. I had no taxes to pay. I had no bills to pay. I had no clothes to buy. I had no old woman to jaw at me. I didn't have to buy any automobiles or support them. I didn't have to do anything. I had it good until I met this group. They come on. Well, eventually, I hooked a ride with a fellow back to Erie, and from there on I hooked rides into Cleveland. I tried to get back into the nest without any success whatever. But
my wife told me about this doctor in Akron and wanted to know if I wanted to go down there and meet him. Maybe he could do something about helping me quit his drinking business. So what could I lose? Sure, I'll go down and see him. So I shan't ever forget her. She was wonderful. She bought me a one-way bus ticket to Akron. She didn't expect me coming back. She bought it and she saw that I got on the bus. She put me on and sent me on down to Akron. And I met Dr. Smith, and he scared the liver out of me. I tell you, I never got so scared in my life. He started telling me all about myself, and he knew too much about me. I couldn't figure this deal out, how he knew so much about how I drank and what I did when I was drinking. I could only conclude that he was a private detective or something had been following me around. Then on the other hand, I got scared because I figured something out. In Cleveland in those days, they had, if any of you folks were up there, there always usually is some in any audience, what they called the torso murder cases. They were finding bits of bodies, arms, legs, and ears, and all kinds of things around wrapped in newspapers, and they could never identify any of these parts of these bodies. They found 7 men and 1 woman, as I remember, and they did identify the woman. They found some fingerprints, and she had a police record, and that's how they identified her. But the men, they never identified any of them. And the police theorized that whoever was doing this cutting up business was either a doctor or a butcher, because he knew something about anatomy. He had a fine technique. And he was doing this for kicks. And he was being nutty, so they nicknamed him the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run. They figured he was taking these derelicts from down here in the hobo jungle in Kingsbury Run, and he'd get them drunk, and then he'd have his fun with them. So this doctor, knowing so much about me, I got thinking, and he wanted to put me away where people couldn't get at me. Then it dawned on me, this is the Mad Butcher. He's been following me around. I'm the next victim. This is a big involved plot. So his phone rang, and when he went to answer it, I left. Boom. You know, I never could forget that man. I got sitting around with some of my jug buddies one day. We got talking about quitting drinking. We get on that subject every once in a while. All these bums along with me. So I told him I was going to quit drinking, and I shall never forget some of the things. You know, some things stick out in your mind. I walked around a blackout a good deal of times, but some of these things I remember. This one thing I remember. When I made this pronouncement that I was going to quit drinking, some of these other jugheads, they got on me. I shan't forget this one guy. He said, You'll never quit drinking. You don't have guts enough to quit drinking. He says, look at you. He says, to quit drinking takes determination. To have determination, you have to have a chin. He says, you got a chin like Andy Gump. You're no damn good. So I had to make the bet good. I said, I'll show you. I know a doctor down here in Akron is going to fix me. He says, nobody ever fixed you. You're no good. So that's how I happened to start calling Doc. And I don't know whose phone I used, because they didn't have telephones under bridges in those days. But I got a hold of somebody's phone. God help him. I would like to know. Really, I can't tell you. Doc told me, I called him about a dozen times. I only remember calling him once, talking to him once. And he asked me to come down and meet him in City Hospital in Akron the next morning, which I did. And that's how I came into the fellowship. I landed in that hospital. I was a sick duck. I weighed 130 pounds. I had been out of work for about 3 years, I guess. Been on a bum. And I lost everything. Everything. Well, when I was in this hospital, here's a routine the boys used to do. I want you to compare some of this with our routines today. These men who were in the group, there were 18 men, came to visit me in that hospital. Every one of them came in and they told me their stories. They told me what had happened to them. As I mentioned before, all these men were much older men than I was. I was only about 34 at that time. And they all told me one thing. They said that they had the answer to my drinking problem, but none of them would tell me what the answer was. The last day I'm in this hospital, Doc comes in, Dr. Bob.
I'll call him Doc, Doc Smith. And he stepped down on the foot of the bed, a very unprofessional attitude. And he looks at me and he says, "Well, young fella," he always had names for everybody. He called me young fella to the day he died. He used to call old Roland Jones Abercrombie. He had a name for everyone. See? This one was Slim, the other one was Red, some of the other something else. But I was young fella at the time he died. He says, "Young fella," he says, "what do you think of this by now?" I said, "Well, I think this is wonderful." I said, "All these fellas coming to see me." The reason I know there was 18, they all wrote their names on a piece of paper at my bedside, so I had their names. He said, "They're all coming and telling me their story, telling me what happened to them. I don't know them from a bale of hay. I don't know why they take all their time to do this." I said, "But they all tell me one thing. They tell me they have the answer to my problem, but they don't tell me what the answer is." I said, "What is this deal anyway? What am I supposed to do?" He says, "I don't know about you. We're not too sure. You're pretty young. We don't know that you're ready yet." "What's to be ready? 130 pounds, no work, no family, no job, no prospects, no nothing. Don't know what I had to do to get ready." Well, this fella, I wanted to tell you before meeting him, I went down there to see him after talking to these men up in Cleveland in the jungle. And I got down there at his office that time. Now, this was before. The first time I went down, I got down to his office, and I walked back and forth in front of his office. He wasn't there. He hadn't come in yet. This is a little aside that I wanted to mention before and forgot it. But I go back and forth in front of his door. Every time I go past there, I read his name, and sign on the door says, "Dr. Robert H. Smith, rectal surgeon." I looked at this sign and I thought, this is certainly a new approach to alcoholism. I didn't know what to expect. But so when he was talking to me in the hospital this time, I didn't know what to expect. So he looks at me. He says, "We're not too sure you're ready for this." So I had to convince him I was. He says, "All right," he says, "I'll give you the answer to this deal." So he looks right at me. Any of you folks ever met Doc? He was a tall, rangy fella, and he had long fingers, about this long. And he stuck his finger at me like this. And he says, "Young fella," he says, "do you believe in God?" Yeah, I wasn't expecting anything like that. I hadn't heard anything about God when I'm in there, and it's been a long time since I was ever concerned with anything like that. And that kind of shook me. A lot of things went through what I take for my mind. I was trying to parry this question, because I didn't know what I was in for here. I'm obligated to a bunch of people and a bunch of religious screwballs, I thought. And how am I going to get out of this? So I said to him, I says, "What does that have to do with it?" Fair question. He says, "Young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you or don't you?" They talk about giving this spiritual aspect of AA with a soft love nowadays. That's the way I got it. I says, "Well, I think I'm stuck." I says, "Well, I guess I do." He says, "There's no guessing about it. You do or you don't." So I had to admit that I did believe in God. He says, "That's fine." He says, "Now we'll pray." I said, "Who'll pray? I can't pray." He says, "I don't expect you can, but you just repeat after me what I say, and that'll suffice for this time." So he uttered a prayer, and I followed him, and felt like a fish, but didn't kill me. So that's how I got started. That night, he took me to a meeting. After we got through with our prayer, he shook hands with me. He said, "Young fella, you're going to be all right." He took me to this meeting, and that was an experience. Now, here's AA in the beginning. This was not known as AA at that time. This fellowship was not known as AA till 1939, after the book came out. The book was named Alcoholics Anonymous. That's when this thing became known as that. Previous to that, this was the Oxford movement. Ebbie Thatcher brought Bill into the Oxford movement. Doc was already in it, but getting drunk just the same. Without it, didn't have any effect on him. And they brought me into the Oxford movement. So they carried me out to this meeting that night. in Akron, a beautiful home. It's the home of T. Henry Williams, the people who were the guiding lights in the Oxford group in Akron, Ohio. They were not alcoholics. Most of the people in that room were not alcoholics. There's an awful lot of people there. And I was quite taken aback. I'd met these men in a hospital, but I wasn't quite prepared for the rest of what I met out there. A lot of women in there, they kind of scared me. They don't anymore, but they did then. And I got over that as time went by. But I walked into this lovely home. To me, it was a terrific experience because I hadn't been in a place like that, not very many of them in my lifetime, but and it had been an awful long time since I had. And rummy-like, of course, when I walked in there, I cast an appraising eye around at all the bric-a-brac and looking for some small things that I might put under my shirt. And there were some pretty expensive little pieces of knick-knacks around there. And they had a big grand piano over here and oriental rugs and all that stuff to go with it. But I didn't take anything. The thought was there, but I didn't. I filed it away. But I went to those meetings every Wednesday night for 15 months. I missed two meetings because I couldn't get through on account of the snow. The buses couldn't get through. I went there nearly every weekend to be with those people. They taught me my lesson. In the meantime, the book was mentioned, was proposed. I went in February of 38 is my anniversary date, and latter part of 38 we started writing this book. That's when the 12 steps were written, the program was compiled. Before that, we'd used the Oxford group program exclusively, and everything was going fairly well, but I could see there's friction between the alcoholics and the non-alcoholics. My great ambition, my driving ambition when I got into this fellowship was to get another prospect, get some guy in that hospital. I wanted to sponsor somebody. I never felt I'd be a real member until I got some rummy to stand still long enough that I could get him in that group. And believe me, I went back there to Cleveland. The first thing I do, of course, went down among my jug buddies and put the B on them. I wanted them to be like me, but they didn't want to be like me. They all thought I was nuts. So I didn't have any luck with these boys, but I kept after everyone I'd see. I hounded saloons. I hounded any drunk I'd find on the street, in it or on it. I would talk to them. I'm quite amused when I read some of this garbage that comes out nowadays about this is a program of attraction rather than something else, I don't know, promotion. If this hadn't been promoted, where in the world would we be tonight? What was there to be attracted to? Rummies don't read newspapers. Rummy has to be found. He has to be inspired. He has to be fired up. His emotions have to be stirred. That's how we succeed with rummies. We don't do it by attraction. Yeah, there's a certain attraction. Once he meets some of us, he sees what fun we're having and how things are, he wants to be like us then, but that's a matter of power of example. I often think of that when I hear some of this stuff. Well, anyway, that's just a little pet peeve of mine. No, I tell you the truth. Where would we be if someone hadn't gone and knocked their brains out to get this rummy and the next one and the next one? Believe me, kid, I remember the first woman I ever brought in AA. I landed in jail twice with her. Was that attraction? Twice I made the can with this one woman. Had a hard time getting out, too. I was sober and she's potted. Oh, boy, I could tell you some stories about some of these people in the early days. I only have the time. But I only have 3 hours tonight. Well, I could see friction between these people. I could see something else. Eventually, I did get a guy. Got my first prospect. First man in. I tell you, that was an experience I shall never forget. I was walking 40 feet high. I found this guy. I should tell you about this fella. Really should. Show you how the deal was. I talked to scores and scores and hundreds of rummies. I'd gone to ministers. I'd gone to people who have rummy problems. and try to get their cooperation. They just looked at me, too. See? They weren't ready yet. I met this guy and his fella, Bill, it was his name, Bill Hess. He was of Polish extraction. He'd worked for Sherwin-Williams for 30 years as an auditor and got fired for drinking. And he'd been broken up with his family. He had four kids and a wife, and they were separated a long time. And Bill was drunk, awful sick. And he said he'd like to quit if there's any way he could. I got a prospect. Well, there's nothing I could do but put him in a hospital. He'd never quit without it. So I wanted to know if he could raise $50. Well, we might as well ask him for to pay off the war debt. $50. But he says he has a mother out in Madison, Ohio, which was 55 miles east of Cleveland. And he says if I go out and see her, she might possibly spring for the 50 to put him in the hospital, his mother. He hadn't seen her for 3 or 4 years, but she might do it. Now, on that bare suggestion, I borrowed some guy's car and took off for Madison, Ohio. And I shall never forget, this was in hunting season, squirrel season. I have a good reason for remembering this, too. So when I got out to Madison, out in this country on this farm, I was going, walking back this lane. I couldn't take the car back there. I was walking back a tremendously long lane to the farmhouse. And I heard guns going off everywhere. I thought I was in a war. And I get about halfway up this place, and here's a horse laying there. And a horse has a hole in him this big, some shotgun. Some of these squirrely friends of Bill's, or relatives, was hunting squirrels and mistook the horse for a squirrel. If he had a hole that big in him, you know it was pretty close shot, you know? So that's the kind of a deal I'm walking into. They're all drunk out there. So I get out there and meet this mother, and she don't speak hello even in English. It's all Polish. A little 9-year-old kid there I used for an interpreter. And through this kid, I wrestle around with this old lady for about 2 hours. Finally get the idea across that I want $50 to take Bill to a hospital and cure him of drinking. And she dug up to 50. That's the first real sales job I ever... That's when I found out I was a salesman. I changed my career. Well, I went right back to Cleveland, went over in the south side in Pollock Town and got Bill, and took him on down to Akron that very same night. I left Akron. I got Doc Smith out of bed, and he put him in the hospital, and I left Akron at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and boy, I was on air. I tell you the truth, I could have run back there faster than that car would go. That's how I felt. I felt I'd arrived. After that, it wasn't hard to get men. Later, we had about a dozen. Let's get back to the idea of the split from the Oxford group. We had about 12 members going down to Akron every week, 12 alcoholics and their wives, if they had any. Well, some of them had wives, some of them didn't. But we had quite a nice little group going down there, and we thought it would be nice if we'd start a group in Cleveland. Well, that was the first fight. Some of them didn't want to do that. They didn't want to break away from the Oxford group. But I felt, and some of the other boys felt, that we had to break away from the Oxford group for two reasons. First of all, there's friction coming in, and I thought that alcoholics could operate better by themselves. And the next thing is, as a matter of, I felt that this thing should have a universality to it, where everyone should have an opportunity of belonging to this and taking advantage of this. If we'd have stayed in the Oxford group, it would have excluded a good many people. It would have excluded the Catholics, because the Catholic Church would not sanction their members belonging to the Oxford group as it was operated in those days. So it would automatically keep them out. We had one Catholic boy down there in Akron, and that's where a guy was muddled up to begin with. And when he got mixed up in his Oxford group with it, he got worse than ever. And the poor guy, there's no help, no hope for him. And you could see that. And the first few fellows I brought into AA were Catholics. I set them down to Akron, and I set them in one of these Oxford group meetings where they're reading out of the King James Version of the Bible and discussing this and that and having open confession on the floor, what they call witnessing, and getting guidance for other people and all that sort of thing. And these Irishmen, they look at each other, then they look at me and wonder what's going on. So we could see it's not going to work. So that's one of the reasons that prompted us to break from the Oxford group. Well, that break from the Oxford group was the first big riot in AA. That was a riot.
I get a big kick out of another thing I read about in AA today that's come out in the last few years. They talk about unity. I wonder who is talking about unity in AA. When did it start? If we had any unity in AA, we wouldn't have any AA. Don't ever forget that when some guy starts giving that unity pitch. Every group I ever see start because somebody's mad at somebody. Yes. And believe me, we started the same way down there. There were some people in the Oxford group who didn't talk to me for 7 years. I'm not kidding you. 7 years, they wouldn't speak to me. And these are well-meaning people, religious people. They're people with God in their heart. Well, anyway. Well, it had to be rough. It had to be in one of those things. About that time, fortunately, in New York, the New York group was asked out of the Oxford group. They didn't have to break away. The people in the Oxford group had it with rummies up to here. These rummies that go in and put the arm on these birds, they go into their homes and walk out with the rugs and everything else. I'll never forget the pronouncement the Oxford group at Calvary House made about the rummies in those days when the split away came there. They said the Oxford group wants nothing more to do with alcoholics, dipsomaniacs, drug addicts, and pickpockets. So we were in good company. So that's when they broke away and started their AA group in New York. Now, there's the beginnings of New York. That's history you don't read in the books, but that's the way it was. It's been a wonderful thing. AA went along in Cleveland there, progressed quite rapidly. Those plain dealer articles came out in the fall of 39, and literally thousands of inquiries came from all over the country on those. Your Texas activity started as a result of that. If you will all remember, there's a chap by the name of Larry Jewell from Houston. He landed in Houston. He was from Cleveland at the time. He's a newspaper man, too. One of the editors of the editor of the Cleveland Press, Louis Seltzer, told me one day that if we could find Larry Jewell, he always thought a lot of Larry. Larry was a good newspaper man. And Larry was on Skid Row. Larry was a lunger. He had only one lung, and that one had a tube sticking out of it. You can imagine the shape, the condition this man was in. And this was the middle of winter again. And Larry is down on a skid somewhere. And he said if we could find him, he would pay his hospital bill to help him get rehabilitated. We found him. And we took him to a dryout joint. And he recovered. And Seltzer and some of his friends paid his bill. He was in the hospital 3 or 4 weeks. And they gave him a choice of where he wanted to go. That climate is no good for a man with a lung condition such as he had and as emaciated as he was. He was in terror. I don't know how he's living. So they offered him a trip, any place he wanted to go in the country, get out of that bad climate. So he chose Houston, Texas. So he started down on the train, and on the way down, he wrote these articles that he took over and sold to the Houston Press. And he got a job there as a result. They were a Scripps Hard paper. He'd worked with Scripps Hard before in other cities. And Larry sent all those original writings back to me before he ever sold them for checking. And they sent me all the proofs from the paper. Now, I have all that stuff at home yet. So that is how your Texas activity started, with a fellow like that. Tremendous thing, a fellow that should have been dead. He wasn't. Well, anyway, AA progressed. Those plain dealer articles came out in Cleveland just blew you. Thousands of members came in no time. Terrific. And it spread all over. Well, now, those are some of the things of the early days. Now, my first hour and 45 minutes is up. We'll get into the program. Let's talk about alkies for a few minutes. An alcoholic is a fellow who can stop drinking, but he can't stop starting again. It's about as good as I can figure out. And who is this alky? I don't think everyone can be an alcoholic. I think the privilege of being an alcoholic is reserved for a chosen few. I don't think no matter how hard some people may try, you can never become an alcoholic. You have to have certain qualifications for it. You can be a drunk. Every alcoholic is a drunk, but every drunk is not an alcoholic. There's a vast difference. I used to drink with a bunch of drunks one time, and I know. And they're still drinking today and doing a good job of drinking. And they're still able to work and run businesses and so forth. I remember, just as an example, some years ago, just prior to this New York trip I had, I was in a bottle gang out in a little town east of Cleveland. And these fellas, this was WPA days. All these fellas were on WPA but me. I couldn't make it. I couldn't get there. I was the Pete. They wouldn't put me on the bloody thing. I couldn't get out there and get that shovel out and Hank lean on it. And these fellas all had an income. They got their $18 a week. And I had a scrounge yet for mine. And I always held that against Roosevelt. Well, anyway, this bunch, we used to really get into things. We stole one saloon keeper out of business, this bunch and I. That's no kidding, we did. We stole him out of business. We used to get in all kinds of jams. These fellas used to do little silly little things. Like one time the police chief got a new police cruiser in this little village, and he used to be hounding us all the time. He come out one night, and he was in that saloon where we were hanging around his joint, looking at us, you know. Johnson was his name, and I'll never forget him. So a couple of boys went out the back door and went around the front and stole his blooming police car, his brand new car. He didn't find it for 3 weeks. They took it down the woods and left it there. If you'd ever found out who did that, we'd still be in jail. But things like that this gang used to do, they were quite a bunch. They used to be awful heavy drinkers, really. Scrounge, they'd do anything. But I remember about 10 years ago, just about 10 years ago, I was having a lot of trouble with throat operations. I had a series of throat operations for tumors. And it required me about 2 years in and out of hospitals. As one of those deals where I have to go in a hospital, then I have to go home, stay long enough to get strong enough to come in and get cut up again, you know, one of those deals. This went on for about 2 years. And in between these things, one day I thought I'd go down and see the ball game. The Yankees were playing. I wanted to go down and see Joe DiMaggio and hit a few up in the stand and stuff like that. I went down to the ball game and see the Indians playing. On the way down, I run smack dab into five of these guys that used to be in that bottle gang that stole the police car and all that kind of jazz. And here they are. They're all half loaded when I meet them. And they hadn't seen me in a long time. They said, "Snyder, where have you been? We thought you were dead." I looked about half dead then anyway. So he says, "Come in, we must have a drink." I says, "Well, I'll go in with you, but I'm not drinking." So I went in and I watched these guys. I'll never forget, this is an object. This taught me something about alcoholics and drunks. These fellas stood up there and they were throwing those in just like that. And as I say, they were all about half gone, half bagged when I got there, when I met them. They drank the same way as they had these many years previous. I hadn't seen those fellas for 15, 18 years, remember. They were all dressed up. They had nice new sports shirts on. They had two-tone shoes. They were clean. And every one of them had a box seat ticket for the baseball game sticking in here. I looked at these donkeys and I thought, boy, there is the deal. Those guys are not alcoholics. I just thought of myself. What had happened to me since I'd seen these fellas before? And what would happen if I take one of those drinks? And I know one thing for sure, I'd never be wasting $2 or $3 for a box seat ticket. I used to go out in the bleachers when I went to ball game. It's that utterly ridiculous. And here these men are in business, and they're working, some of them running businesses. And this is many, many, many years after I had gone on the bum, got all through all this hell that I'd gone through, lost my family, lost everything in the world. And then I started on a comeback. And here these guys are still having fun with booze. Booze was no fun to me, believe me. The big difference. Alcoholics are a type, and I think you can type them. I think I've never met an alcoholic, a true alcoholic yet, who is not a high-strung individual. I've never met one who is not a very emotional creature, deep feeling. I've never met one who is a deep thinker. He's going to do something, but if there's any thinking to be done, that'll come some other time. He'll be doing something, you can be sure of that. But think, no. He's not the type that goes into a brown funk about things and sits there and studies. You know, you very seldom find a pipe smoker among alcoholics.
The pipe smoker denotes the deliberate type of individual. You'll find an oddball in AA once in a while that smoked a pipe, but he has to be the oddball. They are cigarette fiends. They eat them. They are chain smokers. They smoke when they don't even know they're smoking. They are a high-strung bunch. They're very sensitive souls. They're always going around looking for somebody to hurt their feelings. Yeah. They are very lovable people, and they need love very badly, and they respond to it. One of the biggest mistakes people make with alcoholics, and one of the things that has the recovery of alcoholics by many years is an approach to alcoholics that most people take. Well-meaning people. We've all had the same treatment. People say, oh, if you keep on drinking, this is going to happen to you, that's going to happen to you, this, something else. They'll give us 40, 11 reasons why we shouldn't drink. Good logical reasons. We can give them 40 and 12 why we should, you know. They're all good, but it doesn't have any effect. The only way you can ever reach an alcoholic, not through his reasoning, you reach him through his emotions. It's how he feels. No guy is ever going to accept this program and use it and do the sacrificing that's necessary until he feels something real deep down here and feels an awful need of it. He has to come to that extremity where he feels a real need. Then he'll act. Till that time comes, no. That's why sometimes we can kill some of these monkeys with kindness. Sometimes some of these prospects we get need a good kick in the hind end. Yeah, and I've given it to them, too. Yeah. Every case is different because every person is in a different stage when you're meeting. You've got to find out. Every person, every alcoholic has an Achilles heel. He has a soft spot where you can hit him. If you are fortunate enough to probe and find that soft spot where you upset his emotions, to the point where he's willing, where you can make it easy for him to fall in your lap, you've got him. There's ways of doing that. People don't study that anymore, I noticed in AA. They just, today, it's too casual. I claim it is. They expect too much of the rummy. They meet a rummy, a rummy calls up, they say, well, we got a meeting up in such and such a place Wednesday night, come on up. Well, this poor bum, he's out here. Next Wednesday might be next year to him. You know, he don't even know what day it is today. See? And there's so many things can happen between now and Wednesday. There's so many things can happen if he's only 2 blocks down the street or getting there. He needs something else. Then he comes up. Maybe he does get up there. Maybe he does. He sits there listening to some guy up here talking like this. He looks. So what is that going to do with him? This guy needs personal attention. There's no substitute for personal work with alcoholics. He needs that. Well, I can't go into a sponsorship pitch tonight because that's on another talk. But anyway, the alkie is that type of person, and he needs love. He needs to feel that somebody cares about him. And he needs to be trained and shown. First thing we have to give him is hope. We have to give him hope that there's a chance for him. Then we have to build him up, make him feel good. So he comes into the group. You ever notice how they do when they come in? They all stay sober right off the bat. Most of them do. Why? Why do most of these guys come in? They get a free ride here for a certain length of time. They stay sober. They haven't been sober for 30 years, but they come in, they're sober for a week. Why? I don't know. It's a gift. So they come in. After they're here, I think there's stages of development the alcoholic goes through. The first stage is 3 months. That's the first critical period for the alcoholic. At the end of 3 months, he can write a better book than we have. He can run this group better than anybody in it. He knows more about this than anybody. He don't know how a bunch of stupid jerks like us ever got along before he got here. That's 3 months. Oh, he's a marvel. If he lives through that, the next critical period is about 9 months. Because by that time, he is an old-timer. There's been a lot of people who come in after he has, and he's looking down his nose at them. He's getting quite pontifical about the whole deal. And he's telling them what ashtrays they should empty and what mop they should use and so forth. So he lives through that. He gets up to a year. The year is a bad time for many alcoholics, especially periodics. A periodic alcoholic has put a time limitation on himself subconsciously of a year. He's signed pledges for a year. He's taken pledges. He's made promises for a year. He's been sentenced for a year. Yeah, all this kind of, this year thing and all these resolutions for a year, all this stuff. This year is in his noodle. And he's never made a year. He's got up to 364 days already, but he never made that year. So he finally makes it in AA. Boy, I've got it. This is different. This isn't like it used to be. I've made it. So he sits back there and retires. That's dangerous. Well, if he lives through that, the next period of importance is at the end of 2 years. If he has worked and he's been enjoying this AA and he's been trying to learn his lessons, he's been listening to people and trying to put into action what's being proposed to him here, and he's attending this meeting and taking interest in his group, and he thinks he's got the best group in the world. After 2 years, this guy sits down and he finally decides that he don't know anything yet. That's the age of the beginning of wisdom. He don't know anything after 2 years. If he stays with it the third year, after 3 years, then he is able to do a little logical thinking. A little. He's never going to become a completely logical creature. I haven't found any of them yet, believe me. And I hope I don't, because it's going to spoil the whole deal. But he will be able to evaluate things a lot differently. Now, it takes about the average. Now, there are exceptions, of course, but we can only talk about the average. About 3 years, the fellow starts getting pretty well integrated in things. So there you are. I didn't mean to use that dirty word. Well, that's the alky. Now, what can be done with him? Why does he come here and recover? Everything under the sun has been tried for him. He's been in hospitals. You take our composite experience here. We've been in hospitals, sanitariums, jails, asylums. We've been talked to. We've been preached to. We've been preached at. We've been kicked. We've been kissed. We've been praised. We've been damned. We've been advised. We've been ill-advised. Everything has happened to us. And what happens? We just get drunker. We get worse. Then we come to this fellowship, and something happens. We recover. And we find that we no longer have to drink. We find we don't have to anymore. I don't care who the person is that comes to AA. Even if he don't make this program, I'll guarantee you one thing, his drinking has been ruined. He never again can drink in peace. This has cooked his goose. Because he knows there's an out, and he just isn't taking it. Now, did you ever stop to consider what fortunate people we are? I consider I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I really believe that. I mean that. Because I told you how I came in here and what chances I were against me. But think of all of us. Over the years, the many, many years, as long back as history is recorded, we can read in ancient history, we can read in the Bible, we can read in modern history, about the exploits of alcoholics and the effects of alcohol on people and what people did under the influence of alcohol and what people did to try to overcome this thing of drinking. It's been a thing going on for thousands of years. Even old Noah got drunk. Timmy. What's that creature? Gone across the face of this earth, alcoholics, and have died that way. And their families have suffered, they have suffered. And there's millions of people today who are alcoholics, and there'll be millions to come after we're dead and gone. Should you ever stop to consider this? Why do you and I have this opportunity and all these other people didn't? Go home and think about that. Think about that tonight before you say your prayers. I think you'll add something. Terrific. We are chosen people. Don't forget that. Something has happened. We are blessed. You figure it out. Any person that abuses this, he's got whatever's coming to him if he does it willfully. You know, you talk about people who come in AA and they get the advantage of this. They get sobered up and cleaned up and they get on their feet and they get the wrinkles out of their belly. They get a new front. They get a new home. They get a car. They get some jingle in their pocket. Things are going good. Then they forget to be thankful. They forget to be thankful. Then they get drunk. And when they get drunk, brother, things are worse than they ever were for them. There's a piece in the Bible about that. Everything in our program came out of the Bible. Don't ever forget this. There's a piece in Matthew about the unclean spirit. It says, I wrote this down. I carry this with me. Every once in a while, I read, think about it. Read there, goes to this effect. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places, seeking rest, and findeth none. Then he saith, I shall return into my house from whence I came out. And when he is come, he finds it sweet and garnished. See? Then goeth he in, and taketh with himself seven other spirits, more wicked than himself. And they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. You ask any guy who's had the advantage of this program for a number of years, any person, and he forgets to be thankful, and he gets his house in order, that spirit has been pushed out, he comes back and finds it all sweet and garnished, and he brings seven of his devils with him. There's a story for you. You'll find that in the 12th chapter of Matthew if you're interested. Now, this program of ours is designed to do something for us and to us. I want to go over this program in my last part of the little dissertation here. Don't think I came way down here from St. Petersburg, Florida, to talk to you people for 20 minutes. No, sir. You're going to get the full deal. No use talking about rummies and so forth unless we talk about what makes them tick after they get in here. Isn't that right? But we have a program here of 12 steps. And this is it. This is the program. I told you before, mentioned before, the 12 steps were not written when I came in. So I know I was there when they were written. I know what the intent and purpose of each one of these steps is, and I know the origin of each one of these steps, where it came from. And there are 12 steps, if you please. There are not two, there are not three, there are not five, there are 12. And these 12 steps are designed to make new people out of us. And I mean new people. I shall never forget when I was going to Akron. There was a chap in the group there, Bill Van Horn. He just died this past year. Bill preceded me into the group by about 6 months. And Bill was a big, rough, tough individual. He's the kind of a guy that if ever a battle broke out, you'd want to be on his side, believe me. Doc Smith took Bill out of the Massillon State Insane Asylum. His folks had him probated because they couldn't do anything with him. He was a World War I veteran. He got a little pension the first every month, and every first of the month he turned Akron and the whole Summit County upside down. And he wasn't any crazier than the rest of us, only a little more violent when he had money and drink in him. He's like an Indian. So they finally couldn't do anything but put him away. Doc took him out, put him in a group. Old Bill used to pay a lot of attention to me down those meetings. He used to talk to me. Every night he'd get me in a corner and talk to me, give me a lot of encouragement. I was about halfway scared of this big baboon, tell you the truth. And so one night he says, Clarence, I'm going to give you the answer to this whole thing. Here's the key to this whole thing of recovery. He says, I want you to read this. I want you to learn it. I don't want you to ever forget it. He says, if you know what this is, you've got it made. So he reaches in his pocket and pulls out an old billfold, all stuffed with all kinds of papers and junk he had in there. No money, just all junk. The things were precious to him. So he pulls out this piece of paper and he hands it to me. And on this piece of paper was a Bible verse. And I looked at this Bible verse and I looked at this big gorilla. And I just thought for a moment, maybe they took him out too soon. Big guy like him running around giving out Bible verses. But I certainly wouldn't mention that. So I read that, and it was the verse from 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter and the 17th verse. It reads, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. Think about that. That is my setup. You tell me what is. If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. This program. This program was designed to change people, change us from what we were to what we should be. And here's how it's done. These 12 steps, I like to break them down into four phases. The first phase is admission. First is we don't start unless we admit something wrong. So that first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. If we're not willing to admit that, where are we going to start? Okay, if you can't admit it, let's forget it. Start some other time. We have to get to that point. I don't see where anyone would have any trouble with that step. I think most people took that step before they ever found AA. I think we have. We knew something was wrong with us. Our life was unmanageable. So now we start into the next phase, which I refer to as submission. First we have admission, now submission. Step two says we came to believe, get the emphasis on these words, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Didn't say anything about it. We believed that. We came to believe it. How did I come to believe it? I told you something about how I felt when I was in the hospital. I couldn't help it. These men, they told me their story. They'd been through this thing. They all told me they had the answer. When Doc gave me this answer, and those men all had gone through this, I wanted what they had. I was willing to believe. I wanted to believe. So I came to believe that this power could help me. It could restore me to sanity. I didn't have to worry about sanity. Any of us worry about sanity. Do you think some of these things we did, did we claim ourselves as sane? I'm not going into some of the details I told the truth, what a nut I was. I'll let you form your own conclusion. You're all nuts or you wouldn't be here. Step three. This is still in the submission. The second through the seventh step is the submission. It says we made a decision. We made a decision. Isn't that something for a woman to do? We never make any decisions. We're the most way out in some celestial body. Some person we have a very little acquaintanceship with and we've forgotten and perhaps are scared of. We don't know enough about them and we're not well enough acquainted. Here we're asked to turn our will and our lives over the care of this nebulous creature. Well, believe me, common sense is not going to dictate that we'll do that. And we're not going to do that unless we hurt. So I get right back to what I said before. This is an emotional proposition. We're going to do things according to how we feel. And we got to feel awful doggone bad to do that. So this is going to eliminate a lot of the sissies right now. Some of the birds that haven't had enough are not going along with the program from this point, so they're going to have to wait. There's time for some of them. They'll wait. They'll work into it. You have to work into this fellowship. You don't get in here for nothing. This is the most exclusive fellowship in the world. I get a kick out of some of these jokers that run around belonging to these fancy country clubs. They pay $1,000 or $2,000 or $5,000 to belong to this club, and they pay $200 a year dues, and they think they're somebody. None of you monkeys ever got in here less than $50,000 or $100,000. Ever stop to figure that out? Cost all of us that much money to get in this group. Lost opportunities, lost money, the things we lost, and the things that we lost personal. We can't measure it in dollars and cents. There's no fellowship that has the initiation fee that Alcoholics Anonymous has. We should value our membership here. Here we are making a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Tremendous thing. Then our next step is step four. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I don't think there's an alcoholic coming into AA who is capable of doing that by himself. He don't have the inherent honesty to do it. He needs help. That's why I think he needs a sponsor to help him with that inventory, because we have been so accustomed to justifying ourselves and our actions. We never meant to get drunk. There's always some other circumstances that led into all these deals that we got mixed up with. It wasn't our fault, really. We were pretty good guys, you know. So we can justify anything. The next step kind of suggests to me that someone has been helping us with number four, because someone has to be present to take the next step. Because the next step says we admitted. Can you imagine us admitting anything? An alcoholic never admits anything. He don't admit it to anything outside. It might involve him in something. Did you ever go down to court some morning, as an onlooker, as a spectator? Go down there some morning now that you're sober and watch this procedure. Some drunk comes up there before the judge. And the judge looks at him, and the charge is read, and you're drunk. You were drunk. The drummy looks up. Oh, not drunk. You were drinking. No. The guy has just been out in his car last night, and he tipped over a police car. He went through a window, and he fight the police, and they're trying to arrest him, all that kind of thing. See, all this kind of conglomeration going on. Everybody's a wreck. Everything's a shambles. He wasn't drinking. The judge says, well, he says, you were drinking. Finally, after a lot of haggling, the guy will admit the two beers. I have never in my life heard of anything ever happen to anybody that really drank. It's only the guys that had two beers. So if you ever start out, keep away from those two beers, believe me. They're murder. So we don't admit anything. But here we're asked to admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. It doesn't say we have to admit everything we've done in life. It's the nature of our wrongs. What was the nature? Were we envious? Were we covetous? Did we steal? Were we dishonest? Are we unloving? Are we liars? All these different things that you find in taking an inventory. That's what it means. We must admit that to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Put that out on record. Once we get that out of us, it's a tremendous release. That's a stumbling block for a lot of people. They don't take that step. They don't do it. They don't do it properly. It's a tremendous step. Yeah, we admitted these things. Then we get into the next step here. Listen to the emphasis on this step. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. It says entirely ready. It doesn't say we're kind of ready, we're about to be ready, we're rather ready, a little bit ready. We're entirely ready. And an alcoholic is entirely in everything he does. He's an extremist. An alcoholic never does anything by halfway measures. Remember that. When he works hard. He plays hard. When he gets drunk, he makes a career of it. Now, we have to do things that way because we're made that way. That's part of our makeup. And nothing in this world is going to change it. And it isn't going to change it any after we sober up. We're still going to be extremists. It's going to take a long, long time to learn how to take some of these things with a little salt. An alcoholic, he can't wait for anything. He can't wait for tomorrow for anything. You tell him you're going to do something tomorrow? No, that has to be done yesterday already. It's the way it is.
So here's the guy who's entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then he humbly asked him to remove the shortcomings. He humbly asked God to remove them. Remember? I can remember. When I get in some kind of a jam, I'd say, God, you get me out of this and I'll be a good boy. I'll never do this again. I'll never run out with Sadie Glupp again. I'll be true. I'll be this. I'll be a model of deportment. If you'll only get me out of this. Always making a deal. You don't make any deal with God. Says we humbly ask him. Humbly ask him. Good book tells us we ask believing, we shall receive. So we ask that way. So much for submission. Steps 8 and 9 are the steps of restitution. Here are very important steps. And some of good many people have overlooked these steps. It says, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Obviously, we can't make amends to all persons we've harmed. We don't know all the people we've harmed. But we must have that attitude of willingness to make amends. The next step says, we made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. That step needs help. I don't think any new alcoholic should ever set out to make the restitution step until he is helped and guided by a more experienced person in the fellowship. You can do untold damage in that step. It's not done wisely. 10th step starts the steps of construction, 10th, 11th, and 12th. We've had admission, submission, restitution. Now we are constructing a life. The 10th step says we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. That's something for a rummy to do, admit when he's wrong. Any of you folks who have never done that, try it. You get in these ordinary arguments with somebody at work or somebody at home, you know you're all wet, but you'll stand up and swear black as white just to get your point. You won't admit you're wrong. Sometime try it. Just say, oh, okay, George, I'm all wet. You're right. See what a load comes off. This thing of trying to defend ourselves, being on a defensive, we've been that way for so many years, we got to get off of it and go over on the offensive. That step will teach us to do it. This step should be taken every night, every day. Continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, probably admit it. Because our opportunities to fail come so many times every day. We need that step to work with all the time. We have more chances for failure than we have of success. That's why we must pay attention to step 10. Step 11 is a step that teaches us how to pray and what to pray for. Most of us know nothing about it. I know I didn't when I come in. Here's a step that can teach us, no matter what your past affiliation or present affiliation in church-wise or without it is. This step, tremendous step. Listen to it. See what we're supposed to pray for and how we're supposed to pray. It says we sought through prayer and meditation. What are we seeking? We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. What are we praying for? Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Doesn't say anything there about praying for a new job. Doesn't say anything about praying for sobriety. In fact, I haven't seen the word sobriety in all these steps. So, it doesn't say anything about praying for a new wife or a new yacht or a new automobile or a new home or a new job or anything. It says here that we're praying for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. That's how we learn to pray. Very simple. After we get entered into a prayer life through this step, then we can expand on our prayer life. But this can be a beginning for anyone, and it can't harm anyone, and it's not hard to understand. It'll get us to searching and reaching. Tremendous step. Pay a lot of attention to it. Step 12 is the last step in construction. It tells us what has happened to us because of the other 11. It says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. It says nothing about carrying the alcoholic. Just carrying a message. And says something else very important. It says, we had a spiritual experience, a spiritual change. What is a spiritual experience? Some people shy away from talk like that. There's nothing to be afraid of. Just a change of heart, a change of mind, change of attitude, change of person. Where once we were one way, now we're another way. We're entirely different people. Can anyone say that they've met any person in this fellowship of AA who's come in here that hasn't been changed, entirely different than he's been? You go to a meeting some night, you meet a new person in this meeting, it's his first trip in there, the guy is sick and he's shaking or she's shaking and frightened, scared to death, friendless, don't know what's going to happen next, jump and somebody drop a paper clip on the floor and they jump out of their shoes. And they look, perhaps they're dirty, perhaps they stink, perhaps their hind ends out of their britches, their bare feet are on the ground. Many times this has happened. You take a look at this bird. You go back to that group a month or so later. You run into that same Alki, and you don't know him. You haven't seen him for a month or two, you don't know him. His whole appearance has changed. He's an entirely different looking guy. And he's talking differently. He's acting differently. He is different. Something has taken hold of him. Something's come into him. What we have to do is to keep that in him and help him develop it. Every person gets changed when they come here, one way or another. Some people get tremendous changes. It's here for all of us. We can get so much out of this that we don't even dream. One of the few things, I suppose, that's compensation for being what they might call an old timer, being around for a number of years, such as has been my privilege, is this privilege of having seen so many people change. Very few people around that saw mine, but I've seen thousands of them. I worked with thousands of alcoholics in my career. I had that opportunity. After I was in AA for a while, I got on the road and I got to see a lot of these groups who were starting out in their infancy. And I know people all over this country practically in AA. And I've seen these tremendous changes in people, in individuals. And this is an individual matter. And every person has his own change. And every person can be developed. And it's a two-way proposition. He needs help. He can do something. He has to do something. I want to close with this one story as an illustration of that. I always think of the story of the Irishman in the garden. His old Pat, he worked for the city. And he was very poor, and he had a family. And he always wanted a home with a garden. And he lived right on the edge of the city dump. And this dump was cluttered with all kinds of trash, old broken bottles and bed springs and all that stuff that's associated with a city dump. He always wanted his garden, and Pat had been a faithful worker for years. Finally, the mayor told him, he says, Pat, he says, if you want that garden so badly, he says, if you'll clear a section of that dump, you can use it for a garden. Pat was so happy. He went out there and worked and worked. Before he'd go to work in the morning, he'd be out there clearing his place, and after he'd come home at night, and he got his garden planted, and he tended it with tender care. As time went on, summer came along, and flowers are coming up, and his vegetables are coming up. Pat's out there working in his garden one evening, and along comes a parish priest. And the priest stopped to pass the time of day with Pat. He says, Pat, he says, and that's a mighty fine garden there that you and God have. Pat says, sure it is, Father, but you should have seen it when God had it by himself. We have the garden. We have the opportunity. God will help us. God will furnish these things. We must develop them. It's been awful nice talking to you. Come down to St. Pete sometime, all of you. Thank you very much.